The latest round of global climate talks in South Africa are coming to an end this weekend, though they don't seem to be getting quite as much attention as the crisis talks on the euro. The Durban talks have been underway since early December and represent the latest attempt by the nations of the world to find a way to limit greenhouse gas emissions. Erwin Jackson has been observing the talks for the Climate Institute, a non-partisan independent research organisation primarily funded by philanthropic donation. Erwin Jackson, welcome to the National Interest.
Good morning.
It's Friday morning in Durban as we speak. Where are the talks up to?
Well, we're really heading into the final stretch where ministers are trying to nut out the final deal. We've made a lot of good progress on some technical and practical issues, but it's now time for the ministers to come together and actually just decide the final shape and how we move from here.
And what are the key issues that they have to nut out?
Well, the real one is a tension around what is the legal nature of the agreement we're actually negotiating. When all this process started in Bali in 2007, it was actually not agreed that we were negotiating a new international treaty to address climate change. So that has really come to head in Durban about what we are actually trying to agree on, because the Kyoto Protocol comes to the end, the first commitment period of the Kyoto Protocol ends in 2012. So what does the new legal framework look like in the future, and what happens to the Kyoto Protocol as a result?
So if the Kyoto Protocol comes to an end and there's nothing to replace it and it's not extended, we're a bit at sea, I guess.
Well, the protocol itself won't come to an end. It has ongoing institutions that will continue. For example, the carbon markets that were established at an international level under the protocol. What is missing is new targets for Kyoto Protocol countries. And certainly a number of countries, particularly in the developing world, are very keen to see countries like the EU, Australia, Norway, and New Zealand continue their commitment to a multilateral rules-based system, while at the same time trying to work out how we capture the other major emitters in a new system, such as which would cover the US, China, India, and so forth.
And there seems to be a broad tension here about how hard to push for a legally binding agreement rather than more aspirational targets.
That's right, and that's not new. We've seen, even when we started negotiating the Climate Convention in 1992, this tension between, do you ask countries to take on legally binding commitments, which are much harder to negotiate, but countries generally feel more comfortable that other countries are going to implement them, because it has been a hard negotiation, and as a general rule of international law, countries meet their international commitments, versus another system which is more bottom-up, where you see countries taking domestic actions and committing internationally on a more voluntary basis. And the advantage that that has is that countries tend to be more ambitious, or can be more ambitious in the targets that they put forward. So, for example, we saw in Copenhagen and Cancun, countries that represented about 80% of global emissions committing to take action on climate change. If that had been forced under an international agreement, that wouldn't have happened, and we would have had a less environmentally affected outcome.
And I guess if there's a legally binding agreement, then countries are going to play it safe and they're going to only offer lower level commitments, because they're going to be held to them. They're going to sort of pitch it a bit lower.
And that is the risk. But what is different now from when we first started discussing the legally binding commitments that led to things like the Kyoto Protocol is that we weren't, except for countries that were concerned about energy security, improving energy efficiency, not very many countries were actually acting to limit pollution. Now we're in a world where most of the major emitters are undertaking policies, whether they be emissions trading systems, regulations for new power stations, energy efficiency targets, renewable energy targets. So we're actually starting to see countries build their domestic confidence in action. So what we're seeing from China, for example, is it's taking its international voluntary pledges that it's made and putting them under domestic law. And as they become more comfortable with their ability to meet those targets, they will be then more comfortable about committing internationally to those targets, because they will have shown that domestically they can be achieved.
So what that sounds like then is that a bottom-up approach, that bottom-up approach that you were talking about, it is more likely to be successful. All the individual member states doing their own thing and then attempting to draw that all together into some overarching framework.
Well, I think at the end of the day, we're going to need both, because while we definitely need to see countries strengthening their domestic action that they're currently taking, putting in place domestic policies like we've done in Australia, like the Europeans have done, the Chinese have done, you also do need a multilateral rules-based system to allow countries, give countries the confidence and the transparency around what they're doing. You also need to have other mechanisms at an international level to help unlock ambition, and they might be whether they be new market mechanisms, like the build on the existing ones under the Kyoto Protocol, which allow countries to reduce their emissions at lower cost, or they might simply be credible institutions that facilitate financial flows from developed to developing countries to help unlock major new investments in clean energy amongst the world's poorest countries. So there's a role for both a top-down approach and a bottom-up approach.
So those sort of things you're talking about there is to make sure that when someone's, you know, claiming an offset, say a European country or a country like Australia is claiming an offset for something they've done in Bangladesh, that actually is verifiable and provable. Or if rainforest is being protected in Indonesia as a carbon offset, it really is being protected, that sort of thing.
That's right. It's also making sure that countries aren't double counting. But it's when we developed the mechanisms under the Kyoto Protocol, developing countries hadn't taken on targets. Now we're in a world where you say Indonesia, for example, has committed to a target at a domestic level. And what you want to make sure is happening is that when Australia or another country claims credit for action in Indonesia, that both Australia and Indonesia aren't counting that towards meeting their target. So you do need those institutions and rules to make sure you don't get things like that happening.
What has Australia's role in the talks in Durban been?
Well, it's probably happened at two levels. At an official level, Australia has actually been fairly innovative in working with countries like Norway, the European Union, and some of the smaller developing states to actually come up with concrete proposals about how we build a flexible regime that allows us to increase ambition as we move forward. Then obviously we've got a role at a political level, and that's really the role of the minister. And at the end of the day, that's going to come down to a decision at a political level about how we can, one, take on a new commitment period under the Kyoto Protocol or not, as leverage towards getting a broader agreement, which includes all major emitters, and two, working with countries like the United States, Japan, and Canada to create the political space at a domestic level for all those countries to move forward. Because as we've seen in Australia, we've seen lots of misinformation about what countries are doing and what they're not doing. So you do need to see the messages that come out of this meeting being very, recognise the reality of what's actually happening on the ground in all of those countries.
I have read that Australia has been trying to get mechanisms in place that would give us favourable treatment for over land issues, things like, you know, Australia stopping land clearing or halting logging in native forests and that sort of thing.
Well, you always have nation states, and who they are, they'll find issues, which is what they call it, you know, they negotiate very hard politically, but if they call them national interest issues. To be fair, we're not in a situation we were in Kyoto in 1997, where we had a backroom deal and Australia extracted a very large concession from the rest of the world in terms of being able to increase emissions from our power sector, while at the same time counting the emission reductions from deforestation. We're in a slightly different world now because we have greater transparency around those actions. And it remains to be seen, as the process goes forward, how those rules will affect Australia's target. But because we are having a transparent process, countries can see where we're trying to fiddle the books. And as a result, they'll put pressure on us to increase our target.
And how is the geopolitics of the talks working out? Are there kind of clear blocks of interest that have formed?
Well, the geopolitics of climate change have changed quite substantially since Copenhagen. And it was actually one of the more interesting outcomes of the meeting. Because what we saw for the first time is this amorphous block of the developing world, which included G77, China, disintegrating. Now we actually have China, India, Brazil, and South Africa operating as a separate bloc effectively. You also have the least developed countries, the Alliance of Small Island States, and the Africa Group all playing different roles and pushing different strategies within the meeting. So G77 isn't as cohesive. And that's actually creating very interesting dynamics because it's allowing those countries to work with other progressive countries or groups like the EU to put pressure on the other big emitters. So we're no longer in a world where you had this duke them out between the developed world and the developing world with the EU trying to broker a deal in the middle. It's much more complex than it was 10 years ago.
Erwin Jackson, thank you.
My pleasure.
Erwin Jackson is the Deputy CEO of the Climate Institute. He was joining me from the Global Climate Talks in Durban. And of course, if you're listening to the Sunday edition of The National Interest, just a reminder that we were speaking on Friday evening, Australian time.